Are you part of the great resignation? That mass exodus of people who are leaving their jobs to start something new? Then something you need to consider is what to do with your company 401k. Rather than just rolling it over, consider opening a truly self-directed IRA. With a self-directed IRA, a truly self-directed IRA, your retirement portfolio can include real estate, precious metals, cryptocurrency, notes, loans, a new business, and traditional equities like stocks and bonds. You can make any investment the law allows with a truly self-directed retirement account. Listen, you probably have questions, so why not take the time to get the answers? Start with going to IRAAdvantage.com, then talk to the truly self-directed IRA professionals at IRA Advantage.
Would you like to learn more about truly self-directed IRAs? Then visit IRAAdvantage.com, view our videos, and call IRA Advantage. Let us set up a truly self-directed IRA for you. That's IRAAdvantage.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday on the Radio Northwest Network, and it's my pleasure to be with you all over Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. We have 24 great radio stations. And the first thing, before I launch into what I wanted to talk about to start out today, I've got to mention the passing of Tina Turner. We just got the word within the last hour. Tina Turner, one of the great, iconic performers for rock and roll, dead at the age of 83, and boy, what a talent. And about some of the tough times she had to go through and some of the guys she had to put up with, like Ike. God bless her. I know she's up in heaven, and I have a feeling Ike Turner is somewhere else. But welcome to the Lars Larson Show. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, we try to make that easy every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, you can go right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. As you know, the next 18-plus months are going to be very interesting because we're in a major election cycle, including president and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis declared today. And also, a lot of state and local offices are going to be filled. And I want to tell you something. The next time you hear somebody say affordable housing, I want you to shout out a question. I want you to demand that they tell you why affordable housing created by the government is so damn expensive. And I'm going to give you chapter and verse on this. Later on this hour, there's a major controversy that's come up involving so-called affordable housing, which is being financed by you, whether you want to or not, whether you knew about it or not. Hundreds of millions of your dollars, tax dollars, are being scooped up to be spent on affordable housing. So take that into account as you hear these numbers. And I always like to build a solid case. But when you hear politicians, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, talk about affordable housing, understand it is everything except affordable. And here is the numerical proof. It turns out, no big surprise to me, because we've talked about it for years. We've talked to people in the private sector and in the government, and it always stuns me that the government often builds housing that they call affordable with your money. And these are people who have, in most cases, absolutely no expertise whatsoever in building housing. They've never swung a hammer. They've never cut a board. They've never poured a foundation. They've never developed a project. And yet they say, you give us the money, we will build affordable housing. This case is so, I guess, average because it's the kind of a project that you hear about all the time from the politicians. And they always call it affordable. And it's not, because it is horribly expensive. And then later on this hour, we'll talk about the huge financing snafu that was created by the state of Oregon, one of the Northwest states, although Washington and Idaho have done similar things by demanding that when private lenders put up a lot of money to help finance some of this so-called affordable housing, that the state of Oregon said, and unlike other years, when things go south, and they're anticipating that things go south financially in that affordable housing, the state of Oregon wants to collect its share back first at the line of creditors. But we'll get to that later on this hour. Let me talk about one particular case, because I hate to say in general affordable housing ain't, unless I can give you a great example. So the example that does involve this financing snafu that we're going to talk to the Pulitzer Prize winning Nigel Drake was about later on this hour. It is called the Gleason Family Apartments. It's in a neighborhood of Portland called Montevilla. But no matter where they're building it in the state, the state of Oregon could screen, government could screw up an ice cream sundae. So they say, we're going to build 96 units for $52.7 million. And they brag about this, and it's going to be affordable. I'm going to go through the numbers and consider this. If you divide that out, that is for an apartment unit, not for a house, for an apartment unit, that is $549,000 per apartment unit, which I think is insane, even if we only took the numbers that far. But let me take them even farther. It gets worse, because that means the average cost per square foot is completely insane. Now, you say, well, how do you know? I said, well, I checked what the average cost of building apartment units is in the United States in general and what the high and low end is. The average across America is $125. And if you say, well, Lars, but Portland and Seattle are more expensive. Okay, let's start with the benchmark that apartment units cost $85 to $200 a square foot to build in America. The average comes in at $125. Now, when you go to places that are notoriously expensive, San Francisco apartment construction sits at $330 per square foot, and that is a number from February of this year. And in Los Angeles, it's $500 a square foot to build an apartment. But nationwide, the average is between $85 and $200. Portland's latest affordable housing at $52.7 million for 96 units is going to cost, because you find it, well, how big is an apartment on average? You've got studio apartments, 1, 2-bedroom, and 3-bedroom apartments. Most developers build a small number of studios and a small number of 3-bedrooms, and they spend most of the time building a lot of 1 and 2-bedroom apartments. The average for Portland is 765 square feet. That's all the bigger it is. So when you take the cost of $550,000 per unit, and you divide it by 765 feet, it comes out that building affordable housing in Portland, Oregon is going to come in at $718 per square foot, which is more than twice what apartments cost to build in San Francisco, almost 50% more than they cost to build in Los Angeles. And then I'll add in this one other factoid, because it's particularly relevant. The National Multifamily Housing Council, so they represent people who own apartment buildings and complexes and condominiums and duplexes and quadplexes and all that, they figure that of the cost to build housing, apartment housing, 32% of it is government regulation. In other words, you don't have to have that cost in there. Now, the government would say, well, you have to have regulation. You have to have some regulation. Do you think we have too much regulation? I would argue we do, and I would make the case for that. The government, of course, will say, oh, no. If we got to 100% of cost being regulation, that would be their nirvana. If they could get to the point where they were cost, where 100% of the cost of an apartment unit was regulation, and you never actually bought any concrete or lumber or anything else. But this is the insanity we're in. The average apartment, 765 square feet. The average apartment to build it anywhere in America, $125 per square foot. The cost of affordable housing projects like the one I named, Gleason Family Apartments, is $718 per square foot. Now, if anybody out there thinks that's sensible, I'd be glad to take the naysayer call at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Coming up on the Northwest Nonsense, we'll talk about how some of Joe Biden's invited illegal aliens are bringing death in the form of fentanyl to Northwest cities. That's next.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
I'll bet you that life in prison is not what two beneficiaries of Joe Biden's open borders policy expected when they came to Gresham. But when you traffic hundreds of thousands of fentanyl pills into Oregon and get caught, that's what you get. Biden's border policy calls for catch and release for Hondurans like these two illegal aliens. Illegals come to the so-called sanctuary states like Oregon and Washington and Seattle and Portland, where police are literally forbidden to turn them over to immigration officials. Oregon voters gave drug traffickers a boost, too, when they made hard drugs legal to possess. Well, you do get a ticket, but a phone call wipes that out. So a narcotics team caught Hondurans Kevin Martinez Avila and Alan Moya Vargas with a tiny amount of fentanyl, less than 2 ounces. But when they searched their house in Gresham, they literally found hundreds of thousands of counterfeit fentanyl-laced prescription pills and 7 pounds of the deadly drug ready for distribution to Northwest states. So we have a bought and paid for president who won't say boo to Beijing about producing this poison and shipping it to Mexico, where Joe's open border lets it in killer quantities, and then illegals are shown the red carpet by liberal cities like Portland and Seattle. Your kids get high, and far too often, they die. Is that really what you voted for? And more importantly, will you vote for it again? And our question of the day, this one came in anonymously, and I actually reached out to the state agency involved, and I said, hey, is this what you're doing? But this came from somebody on the inside. Should highway dollars go to cleaning up homeless camps? Hey, Lars, I work for ODOT, and you wouldn't believe the nonsense coming down the leadership pipeline. Management announced our marching orders today, and, well, apparently your gas tax dollars are no longer going toward road repair or vegetation control. Instead, it's going to be primarily used to clean homeless camps. According to management, this will also affect our winter maintenance operations. I imagine the general public would like to be aware of this. I prefer to remain anonymous. Glad to keep you anonymous, and I'll bet the public, well, my experience is the public sometimes acts like they don't give a damn. I mean, you really do. You tell them, hey, if they're going to divert all this money to cleaning up homeless camps, in other words, the people who made the mess don't pay to clean it up, you do. And when you pay, there's a finite amount of money, although some Democrats seem to think it's an infinite amount of money in Olympia and Salem and Boise. But when you spend millions of dollars, as they have, cleaning up homeless camps, that's millions of dollars you can't use for plowing snow or fixing roads. And he's absolutely right. They are diverting that money to a population of people who are allowed to camp by the side of the highway, who are allowed to bring in the garbage and the filth and the needles and the human waste. And now it has to be cleaned up. And what happens is you get less service from those state agencies, in this case, ODOT. I reached out to Don Hamilton at ODOT. And I said, look, I want to know what you guys are doing. And is this true? Because apparently people, even within your own ranks, don't like the idea. And they know the public won't like it either. Still waiting to get an answer from Don Hamilton, but maybe it'll come later on. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Better Basements and Waterproofing. Water in your crawl space or basement? Call Better Basements and Waterproofing.
Ah, the grill of the day today goes, this was the headline in the Seattle Times Daily Dead Fish Wrapper. RV explodes in flames as Ballard encampment multiplies by the day. An RV in Ballard caught fire Tuesday on a road that is now littered with trailers, tents, and people's belongings. So, it's not just a big mess. It's not just costing a lot of money. It's literally putting lives at risk, and it's being allowed by the people in public office. And if you don't tell them you don't like it, then they're going to let it keep on happening. I'll get to a call in a moment from a man who actually builds affordable housing in the private sector. But before I do that, today's best email so far, and you can always send more to talk at LarsLarson.com. Kerry French writes in from Kent, Washington. Lars, I saw this about you endorsing Raul Garcia for governor of Oregon. I did. Most of the real conservatives in Washington right now are going for semi-bird because we want to give Olympia the bird. There is talk that Dave Rickard may get into the race or Jim Walsh, so many of us are waiting it out. But right now, semi-bird is the most conservative. I might disagree with that. I think Raul Garcia has the right positions. But he says the mainstreamers of Washington are supporting Raul Garcia. And it was pretty surprised to see that, since I know Lars is very conservative. If you'd like to have Semi Byrd on the show, I can connect you. Well, Kerry, we've had Semi Byrd on the show before. We'll have him on again. I say the more the merrier. It's great that conservatives get to say, we've got multiple choices who are running for both president and for Senate and for governor, and the Democrats have not much of a bench at all. Let's go to Tyler first. Hey, Tyler, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. So I do custom concrete, and say about 10 years ago, you know, for one of my projects, it might require maybe one, maybe two inspections throughout the job. And it was, you know, not too impactive. But as of lately, we don't only have an inspection from the county or the city you're working in, but a lot of projects require a special inspection now through a private company that can cost up to $250 to $300 per inspection. And some of my projects, I could have 9 or 10 inspections through completion of the project. But I would say most of our cost is incurred through OSHA. Some of the new OSHA rules that came out, especially last year during the hot weather, not only drags production down, but, I mean, they're just almost unrealistically able to follow them. And fines are astronomical. So that's where a lot of our costs are coming from.
Well, that's why I mentioned, Tyler, that not only is so-called affordable housing at $718 a square foot to build apartments when the nationwide average is $125 and the high end is around $200, and even in places like San Francisco and L.A., it's $300 or $500, and here's Portland coming in with affordable housing at $718. That's crazy. But the other piece that I mentioned was the National Multifamily Housing Council. So they represent all these people that build and operate apartment buildings. They say that 32%, one-third of the cost of building an apartment, is government regulation, just as you suggest. And should there be ways of streamline? Yeah, there. You should be able to streamline it, shouldn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really easy to streamline. But I would say that is probably closer to 35 to 45% of cost. I think that number is really low. And if you look at pricing from the last decade, I think that it would show you really what it is. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what my rule is, Tyler. Everything done by the government costs way too much money. And if the same thing was done by the private sector, it would be done cheaper. And I've given lots and lots of examples of that. And I'll tell you one last piece that I didn't throw into that little commentary, and that's this. If you go out, Tyler, or one of the people you work for doing the concrete work you do, if it's owned by the private sector, it pays property taxes. If that affordable housing is owned by the government, it doesn't pay any property taxes at all, even if it's worth tens of millions of dollars, and that shortchanges the whole system. I'd rather have the private sector do the whole job. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on this Wednesday. Always glad to get your calls. And naysayers go right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@larslarson.com. Nigel Jacobs joins me now. He is the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter from Willamette Week. I have a feeling Sophie Peel may be the next Pulitzer Prize winner from Willamette Week for taking down much of current state government, but that's a subject for another day. Nigel, you point out in this story you wrote at WWeek.com that one of the first things that Governor Tina Kotek did when she took office was she announced, we're going to create, well, government doesn't really create anything, we're going to create 36,000 units of new housing each and every year. But it sounds like you've documented what none of the other media has covered, that the state of Oregon has blown up part of the very financing mechanism by which she hopes to do that. Is that correct?
That is correct. The state uses some bonds to borrow money, which it then lends to developers at a low rate of interest. And in March, the Oregon Department of Justice was reviewing the standard language in the bond documents, and the Department of Justice decided that they didn't give the state enough security, that the state was in second position or in an unsecured position on these loans, and that was unacceptable. So when they said that, the lender said, well, if you get more security, we get less, and we don't want to be in these deals if we get less security. So they had an immediate urgent deal that was due to close in a couple of days. They had enough money lying around and another pot of money to close that deal, but there are a couple of dozen deals in the pipeline that would produce about 1,700 new apartment units this year that are now under a cloud because the state was going to use this bond financing for all of those. So this seemingly technical change has caused the private lenders like Citibank or Umpqua or U.S. Bank, who are an essential part of every subsidized housing transaction, to back out of the market until they can find some agreement with the state.
I want to make sure everybody understands this. So, Nigel, the state of Oregon makes this bonding possible. And in the past, they've effectively said if the project goes sideways one way or another and doesn't get done, or the revenues don't come in, then all the private lenders line up and they get their piece of whatever's left, like you would in a bankruptcy. And when you say, okay, we're first in line, you're second in line, you're third in line, the state of Oregon would have been last in line. I guess I wonder, on one hand, why was the state willing to be last in line for something that it was making happen? And why did it decide all of a sudden at this moment, as the governor is pushing this agenda, to say, no, we're going to put ourselves first in line. If things go south, we get paid first. The private banks get paid second. And why did they not anticipate that if they were pushing the private banks back in line, that the private banks weren't going to say, well, then we're walking away from it, as they did? Why? How could they not know that was going to happen?
It's a little bit different from that. So the first, the commercial lenders like a Citibank were in first position because they were typically putting in the most money.
Right.
The state was putting in less money, so it was willing to be have a less secure position. They haven't said they want to go ahead of the lenders. They said essentially they want to be equal to the lenders. They want to be co-first position. And if there would be a foreclosure and a liquidation of the product project, they would want to get some of the proceeds instead of only getting paid after the first lien holder gets paid. So it's very unclear why they've made this change now. They've been using these bonds for the past 6 years. They've done dozens and dozens of deals. All of a sudden, the Department of Justice, for reasons that it has been really unwilling to fully explain, has said, we're concerned that's not adequate. And so why they've made the decision remains a little bit of a mystery to not only to me, but to people who are operating in this market as professionals and who've been in this market for years. There's a lot of confusion.
It seems odd because you got the Attorney General's office ideologically aligned with the governor's office, both run by Democrats, Ellen Rosenblum and Tina Kotek. And all of a sudden, the AG's, the DOJ, Department of Justice, says, hey, we want to be at least equal with the lenders. So, you know, if $15 is in the project and $5 came from Citibank and $5 came from Chase and $5 came from the state of Oregon, when it comes time to get paid, you don't pay Chase and Citibank first and the state of Oregon second. They want to be on an equal basis. So if things go upside down and there isn't $15 worth of value left in there, they all three would split it. I understand safeguarding the taxpayers' money against risk. I'm completely in favor of that. But the lawyers who wrote this opinion saying we have to change this never said, and here's why?
They haven't. I've got a pending public records request for the rationale for it. Again, the people in the market, developers, financial professionals who I spoke to for this story, don't know why. And so it is a real mystery, and I hate to go to press with something that I don't know the answer to, but I know enough to say there's real news here because they've already had one kind of unprecedented emergency meeting of the State Housing Stability Council, which has the final say on whether a project moves forward. And in last month, they had to have an emergency meeting really with no notice. They came together and said, this deal is going to fail if we don't find a different source of money because the banks are going to pull out because of the reason you and I have just discussed. So it's a real issue. And I hope to report further about the basis for this issue. But it is a decision the Department of Justice seems to have made to you know, offer the state greater security. So in that sense, it's in the public's interest. The problem is that nobody understands it, and it has a real impact on the ability to produce additional housing, which the state desperately needs.
Okay, so Nigel, unless something changes, does this effectively kill any more projects in the future where Tina Kotek has said we're going to boost this all the way up to 36,000 units per year, which I think is about a 75% increase. I think the state is the state, private and public, is producing about 20,000 units a year. She wants to boost it by 75%, and all these projects are not going to happen because of this change, or am I wrong about that?
Well, no. So the vast majority of housing that is built is not subsidized housing.
Right.
So that will not
Thank
be
God.
Affected by this. The state has very ambitious plans to produce, another 1,700 units based on deals that are set to close this year. And they have asked for vastly more money for the next 2 years. So they really want to just be cranking these things out. And we'll talk later. I know that you're concerned, as am I, that they're very expensive projects. Let's set that aside for a second.
Yeah.
They have big ambitions, and the state has the bonding capacity to do this, but the bonding capacity is not very useful. So these deals all require several different sources of money, and usually the biggest source is a private lender. If the private lenders are saying no, then it really, it really gums up the pipeline.
Well, and as I told you, Nigel, I started off today, but I couldn't believe it. The project you talked about, 96 units at $550,000 a unit, or $718 a square foot, which makes even Los Angeles and San Francisco pale by comparison. And the private sector doesn't build at $718 a square foot. They build at $125 a square foot. And it sounds like nobody's even paying attention to how much money is being spent to do this stuff. You can read Nigel's story at WWeek.com. He is the Pulitzer Prize winner at Willamette Week. Coming up in a moment, we'll talk about Polsbo, which is going to go ahead with its Pride Month display. And in B.C., Vancouver, B.C., public schools are handing out safe snorting kits. We'll get into that in your phone calls and emails. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday. Your calls are welcome, and it's honestly provocative talk radio for the Pacific Northwest. If you want to dial in, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You can send emails, and I get a lot of them, talk@LarsLarson.com. Try to answer all of them, too. Or you can vote in our Twitter poll. The debt ceiling debate endures. It is not over. Joe Biden has spent more than 100 days refusing to negotiate. And now he's saying we're at the edge of an abyss. The United States could actually, by about the 1st of June or a bit afterward, default on its debt for the first time in American history, with probably some fairly consequential effects on the economy, not just on the government, but on jobs, on the American economy, on faith in the American dollar. He might just be doing the Chinese communists who put so much money into the Biden crime family a really solid favor by having America default on its debt, having people around the world lose confidence in the American dollar, because we've always been able to say America has never defaulted on its debts. It has never failed to pay its debts. So when CNN, the Chicken Noodle News Network, went out and they did a survey and they asked Americans, do you think we ought to raise the debt ceiling with cuts? That got 60% of the people to say, yeah, you should only raise the debt ceiling for the American government and allow the government to borrow more money if there are cuts. That's what the Republicans have been asking for. 24%, a tiny number, less than half of that 60%, said, no, just go ahead and raise the debt ceiling, whether there are cuts or not. And then, of course, there's 15% who say you should just go ahead and default on the debt, which I think is catastrophic. But when 60% of Americans say Congress should only raise the debt ceiling if there are cuts in spending at the same time, and that's not a survey done by the Wall Street Journal or a conservative organization or a talk show, that is from CNN. Now, the hard deadline is about June 1. We might get a little bit past that with some fancy accounting tricks. But I'll ask you the question, should the U.S. government borrow more without cuts in spending? And I would say no. I'm with the 60%, and I have been since the beginning of this debate. I feel like asking you this second question, though, not as a Twitter poll, But when Joe Biden, who allegedly got more votes than Donald Trump and allegedly got more votes for president than Barack Obama got, if you actually believe that nonsense from November of 2020. But when he takes the wrong side of history and he says, no, I'm not going to do any cuts. And 60% of Americans, that's not just Republicans, that is Republicans and Democrats and independent voters, all say they only want the government to borrow more if it cuts its spending. And Joe Biden is on the wrong side. I mean, it's no wonder the guy has a falling approval rating and that most Americans, more than half, believe that he's doing a bad job and taking the wrong path. So you can find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Should the U.S. government borrow more without cuts in spending? My answer is no. They should not borrow more without cuts in spending. Today's Twitter poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, yesterday, I told you about the top public high school in America, TJ High. It's Thomas Jefferson High in Virginia. And it's one of those schools, and they're present in a number of cities, where you actually have to take an entrance exam, even though it's a public school open to all. But to get in, you have to show you're part of the best of the best. You have to show that you have the smarts. And all that takes is studying hard. In fact, there are an awful lot of kids who come from average or even less than average families economically who just apply the skull sweat. They get with the books, they do their homework, they study hard, and they score top scores, and they end up in the number one public high school in America. Except TJ High is now proposing to limit the number of smart Asian kids. Say, we can't have too many of those smart Asians. We want to let some dumber kids in. We want to let in kids who are black and brown and white, who do not make the academic qualifications that these other kids have, but we need to make space for them, so we'll just limit the smart kids. We aren't going to have as many smart kids getting in. We'll have some kids who are not as smart, not as capable. Should government high schools limit smart students to let the dumb students in? 94% of you said no to that question. Only 6% of you said yes in answer to that question. Again, the poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. Now, let me mention a couple of things quickly. The city of Poulsbo got a lot of feedback from its citizenry saying, we don't want to have a Pride Month display in the city of Poulsbo. Poulsbo City Council did not exactly represent its constituents. They said, we're going to go ahead with it during Pride Month in the month of June. And meanwhile, and this is almost so crazy, you'd think it came out of the Babylon Bee. In Vancouver, BC public schools, they had a guest speaker in to talk about drug safety. And you know what he handed out to these high school age kids? And I have every reason to suspect this same kind of thing is probably happening in America as well. They handed out what are called safe snorting kits because apparently they've decided it's dangerous to inject cocaine or heroin or other drugs into your veins. And it's a lot safer to have a little card to cut it up into powdered lines and then something to inhale it. So they call it a safe snorting kit. What would you do when that thing shows up in your local public school? You're listening to a Wednesday on the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Do you have investment properties you're considering selling and would like to learn how to defer the tax consequences? Then you need to call Equity Advantage and learn about a 1031 exchange. A 1031 exchange is a powerful investment tool. It enables you to keep a property's equity intact when it's used to acquire like-kind replacement property of equal or greater value and equity, even if you recently acquired the property. For over 30 years, Equity Advantage has been providing investors solutions for deferring taxes and maximizing the value of investments through a 1031 exchange. At Equity Advantage, we don't sell investments, but rather provide the tax deferment tools and expertise to facilitate their sale and transfer. Learn more by going to 1031exchange.com or Google YouTube Equity Advantage for in-depth videos. Listen, you've worked hard for the money in your investments. Equity Advantage works hard to keep it yours.
Learn more about 1031 exchanges and Equity Advantage at 1031exchange.com. That's 1031exchange.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday, and it's my pleasure to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network, serving the needs of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk. Now, I want to pose a rhetorical question that you know I've already answered for you a number of times. Would shoveling a lot of cash into schools produce a different result in the public K through 12 schools? Well, of course, all the research and, in fact, practical experience shows it does not. Washington State did that. They literally doubled the school budget in a 10-year period. That's a 100% increase in 10 years. It actually ended with kids with lower test scores and poorer results. Now, of course, the unions went away richer and the teachers went away richer and the kids got less and the taxpayers got less. So when I saw a suggestion from Republican Representative Jeff Helfrich, who I've run into over the years as a Republican, used to be a cop, Representative Helfrich, welcome back to the program. I think people were taken aback when you mentioned the massive tax kicker, estimated now at $5.5 billion, that'll go back to taxpayers. And they thought Representative Helfrich is proposing taking some of that tax kicker. Were you?
Absolutely not, Lars. One, thanks for having me on the radio and letting me explain that. It was a bad headline. I don't know if it was clickbait on whoever put that out there, but they fixed it. They looked at it, and I said, that's not what I said. That's not my intent. You know, that kicker is in the Constitution. People get to spend their money. I believe, and the rest of the Republican Party believe, that the people that spend their money, that go into taxes, and once they find out, that, or once we've figured out in the budget that we have overpayments, they get that money back, and they're able to, I believe, and the rest of Republicans believe, that the citizens know better to do with their money than we do, and let's let them have their money back. And that's, I fully believe that, and I fully support that. I think it was just a bad headline on the article, and, you know, moving forward, it's need to be a little clearer on that. I knew what I meant in the article, and the article clearly states that, but the headline was a little bit awkward to read. I could see that.
Although, I'm going to push back a little bit on that, Jeff, and I'll tell you why. If you have, there's a revenue forecast, this would be like a man or woman saying, I expect to make, if they're in a commission job, I expect to make this much money in the next 6 months. So maybe they plan to spend the money, or maybe they say, maybe I won't make the money, and they plan not to spend the money. Every time the legislature gets a revenue forecast, it says, hey, you got an extra, I think, $1.6 billion. Immediately, all the Democrats and even some of the Republicans say, I know exactly where we can spend it. If you don't spend that excess income that comes in, does it not flow to the kicker?
No, it does not. It would go back into the general fund dollars. It's the overpayment is what the kicker is for. When the revenue forecast, the prior year revenue forecast comes out, then that's what they're forecasting coming in. And then anything above and beyond that, that's when the kicker kicks in at a threshold. And I don't have that threshold off the top of my head to give you.
Okay. 2%. And
it's, I guess, do you I'll take that back. It's 2% okay. Above
the budgeted amount, right? Not estimated, projected.
Yeah.
The amount you're expecting to spend. So if you collect more than you need to fund the state's operations as budgeted, you send the excess back. So tell me this. Do you think there are good economic times ahead, stable economic times ahead, or perhaps bad economic times ahead?
I wish I had the crystal ball. I think we have better economic times ahead of us. We're trying to create certainty in Oregon with our CHIPS Act. And, you know, that's a big thing coming up. It depends on what's going on at the national level, too. You know, the interest rates are rising, so people aren't spending as much money, whether it's on cars or houses. They're really tightening their belts like we all are. And I think we have opportunities to create that growth here in our state. But we do have a rainy day fund, and that's what we save a lot of our money to, is for that rainy day fund.
Okay. But it means
let me push this other part out there with you, Lars.
Yeah.
The governor wanted to sweep that rainy day fund to fund her pet projects, and we said no.
Good.
And so that's,
I'm glad to hear it.
We pushed back.
Now,
I just want to give you a piece of breaking news real quick.
What's
that? Senate Democrats put Senate Bill 744 for a public hearing next week. And what it says, the headline is, it discontinues the return of surplus revenue refunds to taxpayers. The Senate Democrats now want to take our kicker away from us.
And I'm well aware of that. They've tried every single session. They've tried to take the kicker away. Let me ask you about this, though. You've now proposed, you say, we want to fully fund education. And school districts have said we need $10.3 billion. The governor's budget said $9.9, about a bit less, about $500 million less. And you've said, let's fund it to $10.4. Why would you propose? Say again.
Representative Kramer put that out, and I supported her bill. I co-sponsored or I sponsored the bill with her.
Why would you propose that kind of increase in spending in schools, and does it actually translate to a better result for the students?
So the first part of that is the majority party has always said we need to fund schools at the full level. They never have. We now have the opportunity to fund them at the full level, and if, in fact, the outcomes aren't positive, we'd have to look at structural changes, but we would be able to get the school districts to say, yes, you gave us the money we needed. We still have the same outcomes. Well, then structurally, we need to look at how we're teaching our kids and how we're moving forward, because the Democrats can no longer use that as a talking point that we need to keep funding the schools because we funded them at the level they requested.
Yeah, but there's no indication that funding schools with more money improves the outcomes. Do you have any evidence that that actually works? Because I can cite you lots of examples. I cited Washington State, where they doubled the funding in a 10-year period at a time when student populations were stable. So they had 100% increase, and they produced worse results at the end.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that part of that question?
Yeah, I'll say it again. If you have any evidence that says if we spend more money, the kids will do better in school.
Right. Again, I'll go back to what I said, if we fully fund them. But the other part of that is if the outcomes aren't there, we can talk about our school choice and go back to parents getting them into a school that they want to be in, that they're going to learn in. This is the experiment. This is where, like, you get what you want. Here's your proof to us that you're going to teach our kids right, because we're coming out of a pandemic.
But Representative Helfrich, at the end of that, you'd turn around and say, okay, we funded you fully. You didn't produce a result. Now we're going to cut you. Are you actually saying that'll happen? Because I've never seen a school budget go backwards, not once in my life.
I will say this, Lars. Elections have consequences, and if we are no longer in the minority party, that is my commitment to redo budgets if we don't have the positive outcomes. And so I can't say that in being in the minority party, but I can say that if we're in the majority, that's what I would do, yes.
That you would cut the school budget from 10.4 back to 9.9 or 9.0, say, we're giving you more money, you're not producing better results, so therefore you don't get the money anymore. You would say
right.
That.
We would reform the schools so they would get the proper funding for what they need to do. We're not going to cut the budgets to zero, don't get me wrong. But
I didn't say
what
zero.
What we would do is we'd reform. No, I'm saying we would reform the schools and how they teach kids, go a top-down reform process. When we're in the majority, we can do that. Right now, all we hear back is from the Democrats is we need to keep funding, and they keep just falling a little bit short of funding them fully. And why is that?
Yeah.
Because they want to keep having that argument, I believe.
I want to have you back sometime to talk about school reforms and whether that's ever likely to happen. But that's Republican Jeff Helfrich, member of the state legislature, Republican representing Oregon's District 52. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. When you support BLM, or the company you work for supports BLM, or the major companies that we buy so many things from, whether it's Nike or other companies, when they support Black Lives Matter, are they just actually supporting a scam? And are they continuing to support a scam? Although some of them seem to have been wising up. Because there was a time when Black Lives Matter raised about $90 million in the year 2020. Because, of course, you had the George Floyd riots. You had all this other nonsense going on. And out comes Black Lives Matter and a racist organization based on a lie. The lie was, hands up, don't shoot. And that was, of course, the lie about what Michael Brown, a young man who assaulted a cop once and was trying to assault him again when the cop was forced to shoot him in self-defense, and Michael Brown died. And the story went that Michael Brown had been simply standing there minding his own business with his hands up saying, don't shoot, when in fact he was charging that cop. Well, let me tell you more about this scam and just how disgusting it is, because even though the amount of money that they've been raising this year and last year seems to be down dramatically from that big year of 2020, they're still raising a lot of money. And you know what? They're still paying the people at the top millions and millions of dollars. This is nothing more than a very public scam to scam money from major corporations who pay the money to assuage their guilt, their guilt over race, their guilt over a thousand different things. But first, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. If you're a naysayer, I'll put you right to the head of the line. Because if you believe that Black Lives Matter is actually a legitimate operation, I'd be glad to hear the argument. But glad to have you with me. And thanks for joining me on the Radio Northwest Network, proudly serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the past 23 and a half years. Now, about Black Lives Matter, the first time that I interacted with Black Lives Matter was in the summer of 2020. And you know what I did? I actually walked up to some of the people who were marching around with a bullhorn, with a sign. They were with Black Lives Matter. And I said, I'd like to talk to some of the people with your group. And in fact, I do a national radio show and a Northwest radio show. And what I'd like to do is get you on the radio so you can tell everybody what the cause is that you're pursuing. That was the year in which they managed to scam $90 million after the death of George Floyd. Of course, the incident I referred to, the hands up, don't shoot, that had happened in Ferguson, Missouri, considerably earlier, and it was called out fairly quickly as the lie that it was. Well, it turns out that last year, the tax documents are now in, and the Washington Free Beacon reported on them. Last year, 2022, they were actually bleeding cash all over the place, meaning they weren't making as much or taking in as much as they had. In fact, the Black Lives Matter Global Network Foundation, according to the Beacon, ran a deficit of $8.5 million, and they even had investments. They got so much money in 2020 and 2021, they actually had some of it stashed in investments. And the value of its investments dropped by about $10 million. And in fact, the group logged one loss on the sale of some stocks, some securities. They lost almost $1 million on one of them. And they sold it off at $172,000, meaning they lost 85% of the money. So some of the people and some of the businesses that funded Black Lives Matter, mostly to insure themselves, that is, there are companies that will make a big contribution to a popular political cause, or in this case, a racist cause, with the aim of trying to say, well, we're not bad people. We're not operating out of white privilege because we've given lots of money to BLM. But even though they were losing money, $8.5 million deficit last year, according to their tax filings, that did not stop them from, as the Washington Free Beacon puts it, doling out seven-figure contracts, not six. We're talking millions of dollars to the family and friends of its former executive director, Patrice Couleurs, who once said that the charity financial disclosures were triggering and deeply unsafe. In other words, they didn't want to have to tell the public how much money they were taking in and how much they were spending. Even though if you run a private nonprofit, you're required by the laws in the United States to say how much money you raised, where you raised the money from, and where you spent the money. Now, Black Lives Matter's latest Form 990 filing, tax filing, shows the group is on a fast track to bankruptcy, financial insolvency, and that apparently what Patrice Couleurs had done before and then was succeeded by Shalomaya Bowers, that they're just bleeding this thing down to nothing very, very quickly. BLM raised only $9.3 million in 2022. That was down 88% from the year before. People had figured out the scam. And BLM was forced to shut off its online fundraising streams in February of last year because of compliance and transparency. They were breaking the law in how they raised the money. The group has blown through two-thirds of the $90 million that it raised in that first year, the year of George Floyd. So in other words, they brought in a lot of money based on the death of a man who had no connection to the group whatsoever other than his skin color. And then they went out and they spent $12 million of the money on luxury homes in Los Angeles and Toronto, in Toronto, Canada. And it didn't slow down last year. The charity dropped another $10.5 million on contractors, and much of that went to companies strange how it works out this way, that are linked to friends and family of Patrice Couleur's. Couleur's brother, according to the Washington Free Beacon, Paul Couleur's, was a graffiti artist who had no prior experience as a bodyguard. And yet, he and his two companies raked in $1.6 million for providing professional security services for Black Lives Matter in 2022. Sounds like a no-show job to me. Paul Couleur's was also one of BLM's only two paid employees during the year. He collected a salary of $126,000 a year as the head of security on top of his consulting fees. And then BLM disclosed about a year ago, in May of last year, it had paid Couleur's $841,000 to protect one mansion, a $6 million mansion that Black Lives Matter bought in Los Angeles during the 2021 year. Patrice Couleur said she used it to film herself baking peach cobbler in the kitchen. And the charity told the Associated Press it could not entrust its security to the former police officers who typically staff those private protective security firms because, you know, you can't trust the cops. Frankly, I don't think you can trust Black Lives Matter. And I kind of wish that some of the companies who got ripped off by BLM, you know, where they wrote giant checks, six and seven figure checks to BLM, I wish those companies would come out and declare, we were had, we were cheated, we gave money for a cause, it didn't go to the cause, it went to fancy houses, it went to a lot of friends and family of Patrice Couleur's. But I have a feeling, given these days and the politics these days, they're not going to do that. They're just going to wash it off and say, hey, it was money well spent. It kept everybody else off our back on racial issues. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you and glad to take your calls in a moment. I want to talk about social media. I have as much concern as you do. I have a 7-year-old granddaughter, and I worry about social media and her. And her mother keeps an eye on her. Her father keeps an eye on her. Grandma and grandpa keep an eye on her because we understand social media is full of a lot of garbage. And in fact, it even provides a window into your home and into your family for predators who might be going after kids. So the question comes up. Should the government ban social media for kids under 13? And could you effectively enforce that ban? And the alternative to that, which I would ordinarily favor, which is parents should make great choices for kids. I don't like the government stepping in instead of the parents, but that may be necessary in this case. It depends. Jessica Malusian joins me now with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Jessica, welcome back.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you very much for that. Tell me this. Should there be government regulations that say if you're under 13, we don't want you on social media at all? And should that be the government? Because this is one, Jessica, where it kind of caused me to be torn over my philosophical belief that the best decisions for children are made by their parents and not by the government. Because the government is trying to push a lot of other garbage on them, like saying you can change your gender, you can get an abortion, you can go on birth control pills, lots of things that are being pushed on young kids of that age because the government takes the view that, well, this isn't any of a parent's business. So I don't want to take that away from them. But is it going to be effective if we simply say, well, let's let parents decide whether their 13-year-old or younger should be on social media and let the parents monitor it? Because philosophically, I'm more in favor of letting American citizens and citizen parents make those decisions. But if that's not going to be effective, maybe we need to go the other route.
No, I mean, I think you're exactly right. Your instincts are correct. And it doesn't mean that there aren't concerns and this might not be a problem for some families, but it does mean that, you know, we know that not every problem has a policy solution. And I think that's really true of this. And for all the reasons you said, you know, the same old boring wisdom applies here, right? Parents know their kids better. Every family has different shades of values, has different circumstances. And they're the ones that need to be in control of how much and at what age and what's off limits and what's not. And I think, you know, part of what gets lost is social media is relatively new to a lot of us. So, you know, I think sometimes parents feel like they're not empowered to make those decisions. So that's why I think it's a better path to direct parents and the learning curve to all these tools that these platforms provide for parents to control the amount of time and what kids see online. It's a little bit of a learning curve. It's true. And it's annoying because, right, the right answer is often the hard answer. Parents need to step up, take control of this as much as possible. As kids get older, that does get more difficult. But again, as kids get older, they're probably more able to deal with more of what we see online. And you know, we don't want to keep kids completely off of this because as adults, they're going to have to live in a world where there is social media. And to not learn how to moderate and how to be savvy, it's a real missed opportunity, I think, if you just kind of go with this ban outright.
Yeah, and in fact, who is it then in Congress that is pushing this idea? Because it sounds like something the Democrats would not like in terms of banning you from social media, but it also sounds like something Republicans wouldn't either. So who is it that's pushing the idea of banning social media and letting the government take control of things instead of the parents?
Well, I have to say, I think this is sort of the worst instincts from both sides, right? There's some Democrats who like this because it's about government control, and yep. There's some Republicans that like it because it's kind of a politically opportune way to beat up on big tech. So you see recently bills from like Senator Tom Cotton, who I think it's fair to say wouldn't want parents to be stripped of their decision making with their kids in a lot of other areas. But, you know, I think the concern is genuine. I just think that this is a poor solution. It has a lot of unintended harmful consequences. You know, when you talk about banning it by age, well, that means that everyone who's on social media has to verify that they are over 13, right? Or they're over 18.
And by the way, Jessica, let me throw in, when, say, I have a lot of social media connections online. Most of them are because of work. I don't really use it that much for fun, but I'm on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and Truth Social and all the rest of that. But when you do that, when you have to confirm how old you are, what's the best way to do that? Give up your name, your date of birth, your maybe picture ID, things like that. And all of a sudden, to get the ban for 13-year-olds, you have to gather all this data from adults that many of us don't want to have social media tech companies gathering. So how do we get around
that? That's exactly right. Well, you really can't. I mean, there's some biometric data solutions, but I don't think that having your retina scan seems that much better to me.
Not so any better. How about fingerprints? How about your firstborn? You know, all of them are bad solutions, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. And you know, the ability to speak anonymously is something that's sort of been enshrined in the structure of our country. It's a really important part of the First Amendment. And you're going to take that away if you're having people upload their government IDs in order to be on, you know, Instagram or Twitter. It's kind of ridiculous, but it is what has to happen when you start putting in these age bans. So not only are you stripping parents of their authority to manage their kids' time online as they see fit, but you're also stripping the entire population of their right to speak anonymously online. So, you know, this seems to be something that's going to cause just as many problems as it's trying to solve. Yeah. And I think really the answer here is there's so many resources for parents to be more savvy and more in control of what their kids are doing online. I think that that's an important educational opportunity parents don't take enough advantage of.
You know what I'd like to see, Jessica? I think this is the ideal solution. And you tell me what you think. I think the industry should control itself. And I'll give you an example. I work in radio. I started 48 years ago. Do you know how many commercials are on in every hour on the air? 14 minutes. Do you know how many are on today? 14 minutes. And people say, well, that's because the government regulates. And I said, no, the industry didn't want the government to regulate it. So they said, why don't we just voluntarily say, we're going to limit commercial matter to 14 minutes an hour. It's great. Less than 25% of every hour of radio is commercials. And now newspapers were 25% content and 75% ads. So radio beat newspapers all day long back in the newspaper days. But the industry regulated itself and policed itself. And so is there any sign the social media companies would say, we understand we want lots and lots of eyeballs on our social media because that's advertising and that means the cash flow that runs those companies. But, you know, kids 13 and under don't have any money to speak of, and for the most part, can't buy. They're not buying pickup trucks or life insurance or houses and mortgages. So, you know, and there are products sold to kids. Why doesn't the, is there any sign the industry is capable of getting together and saying, why don't we police ourselves so the government doesn't do it?
Yeah, I think we're seeing some encouraging signs there. You know, they have every incentive to want to allow kids in a responsible way to be on their platforms. And TikTok a couple months ago has limited, it's a 60-minute screen time for anyone under 18. They've done that. No one mandated that. They just did that because they want parents to continue to allow their kids to be on their platform. And Facebook and YouTube, all of these companies have whole websites devoted to all these tools you can turn on as a parent. So I think that that is there, but you hear so much less about that, right? That doesn't really benefit politicians to say, well, the industry has responded, but we would like our soundbite to be prominent. So I think there are lots of things out there that the industry is trying to do, and it's not perfect, but you know, that's fine. I think parents do need to push back and say, we want to be put in control of this situation. We have some concerns. The jury's out on, you know, how and if social media is bad, but I think it's probably like everything else, right? Some kids can handle it younger. Some kids need to wait longer. These are individual decisions. And I think the way to go forward. Yeah.
Jessica, thank you very much. That's Jessica Malusian from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Back in a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. Always glad to get your calls. I want to go right to calls, but literally producer Donovan Sargent just sent this to me. This just broke today in the last couple of hours. Microsoft has uncovered, this sounds like science fiction or the Babylon Bee, it's not. And this is from Microsoft, and I understand, I have the same skepticism about Microsoft that I'm sure a lot of you do as well. But Microsoft has uncovered stealthy and targeted malicious activity focused on, this is a more of a tech article, focused on post-compromised credential access and network systems discovery aimed at critical infrastructure organizations in the United States. Now, they don't say which, but I would take critical infrastructure to be banking systems, water systems, sewer systems, power systems. Microsoft goes on to say the attack is carried out by Volt Typhoon, which is a state-sponsored actor based in China that typically focuses on espionage and information gathering. Microsoft assesses with moderate confidence that this Volt Typhoon campaign is pursuing development of capabilities that could disrupt critical communications infrastructure between the United States and Asia during future crises. You can imagine why China would want this to happen. They say if we get into it with the United States over Taiwan, we already suspect that China, and this we talked about a month ago, had cut some fiber optic cables between Taiwan and one of the islands that is part of the nation of Taiwan. Because despite what the Chinese Communist government says in mainland China, Taiwan is its own country. Now, what they say is Volt Typhoon, this organization that is, you know, trying to do a targeted attack on critical infrastructure in the United States, has been active since mid-2021. It has targeted critical infrastructure in Guam and in elsewhere in the United States. In this campaign, the affected organizations span communications, manufacturing, utility, transportation, construction, maritime, government, information technology, and education sectors. It suggests the threat actor intends to perform espionage and maintain access without being detected for as long as possible. I'm going to get you more information on this as it's available, but wow. I mean, does it surprise you that China would try to attack critical infrastructure in the United States and then create the opportunity anytime they want to turn out the lights, so to speak? I'm not surprised by that. I think we should have expected that. The fact that we've actually caught them doing it at least gives us an opportunity to respond. Let's go to John in Ferndale, Washington. John, welcome to the Lars Larson Show, and thanks for listening. What's on your mind?
Well, I was just wanted to make a comment on your portion on BLM. Several years ago, I watched a segment from Glenn Beck on The Blaze that dealt with, he had tax documents from BLM, and also what he said was the parent company, where all the money actually went to that company. Yeah. And I forget the name of that one, but it had a very nice.
That's what I mentioned, that they raised a lot of money, and the information we gave out today is more recent. It's from their most recent tax filings, and it shows that BLM, Black Lives Matter, is just a major scam organization that's raised millions of dollars, much of it from companies whose names you know, and that they've spent it on themselves. So they're nothing more than common thieves, is the way I look at it. Did you have any comment on it, or did you just want to tell me this was reported?
Well, I'm just saying that 3 years ago, Glenn Beck went...
Yeah, I know about Glenn Beck. Thank you very much for that, John. Apparently, John doesn't listen to the producers of this show at all. And when you break the rules as the producers lay them down, then we go elsewhere. And there's a reason for that, John, so please take that to heart. Let's go to Brian in Vancouver. Hey, Brian, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Yes, good afternoon, Lars. Appreciate your show. Hey, you were talking yesterday about the time entry permit system that they're talking about at Multnomah Falls, and I actually would support that, and there's a couple points that I'd like
to
make.
You do?
Yes, I do.
Wow.
Yes, I
do. Okay, tell me why.
First of all, I don't know if you've ever used the time entry permit system.
I have.
This is Arches National Park, and it was a very well thought through system.
Okay, Brian, can you tell me, how does this benefit the public? Tell me what the benefit to the public is.
It benefits the public. Well, first of all, you know, it's a very short window, right?
Yeah, 60 minutes. So you're going to see a waterfall that everybody owns, the public owns, and the public has to pay money and get a ticket to be there for 60 minutes. You're not guaranteed to get a parking space. You can only stay 60 minutes. It will probably wreck the local vendors who offer restaurant services and other services there. How does that benefit the public?
Well, first of all, You're not limited to 60 minutes. You have a 60-minute window to enter. Once you're there, you can stay as long as you want. So it's not like, hey, you're kicked out after 60 minutes.
A way to do that. But why should I have to have a ticket to go and see that? In other words, if you're driving by and the parking lot is full, most people would not stop. But if you're driving by and the parking lot's half empty, but you can't stop because you didn't tell the government days ahead of time that you wanted to go to a public attraction?
Well, it's a day or two ahead of time. You know, if I'm going during a summer day, I'd like to ensure that I'm able to get in. You know,
but you can't. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and it's my pleasure to be with you. This segment of the show brought to you by NickShivers.com. For an instant offer to sell your home immediately, just go to Nick Shivers. No showing, no hassles, and you pick the closing date. Our Twitter poll today, the debt ceiling debate endures. Should the U.S. government borrow more money without cuts in federal spending? A CNN poll. Get that. A CNN poll says 60% of those polled by Chicken Noodle News Network say that the debt ceiling should only increase if spending cuts come with it. I would say they should not borrow more money without cuts in spending. Today's Twitter poll brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, on the phone with me right now is Senator Phil Fortunato from Washington State. Senator, welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks for having me on again. I appreciate it.
I kind of went on a tear yesterday, and I said, I can't believe that we've got this Senate Bill 5187, and Jay Inslee, who's allowed to do line item vetoes, meaning he can go into a bill and say, I'll let the rest of the bill become law, but I'm marking this part out. And part of what he marked out would have simply required that when the state of Washington is about to release a predatory sexual offender, a convicted criminal, when they're about to release this person into a community, they have to warn the community. How in the world do we get to the point where the governor of a state would say, no, keep the community in the dark. Don't give them the ability to protect their kids.
Well, the problem with the veto is the most of the veto is centered on notifying the tribes of this. So it also included the community, but the focus of the veto was primarily getting the tribes involved and making sure that the tribes approved of this person in the community. But the law already requires notice. The problem comes in is I ran a bill, what the heck is the bill number here? 5739, which says, all right, you're going to send out this notice, which they are currently doing after the fact. The guy's already in the community. The guy's been there for 3 months, and then they have a community hearing notifying the community, oh, you know what? You don't have any input whatsoever. You just have to live with this guy in your community, and we're just telling you this. So I had a bill, 5739, which actually moved that notice to before they release the guy. So when they're right. thinking of releasing the guy, then they notify the community, so the community has an opportunity to respond and object if they want. But right now, they do notify them after the fact. Now, and then the other thing is that they can release these people within 500 feet of a school. 500 feet? Are you kidding me? I mean, they release these people into my district in Enumclaw in sight of a school bus stop. And the response when they brought that up, that these pedophiles are within a couple hundred feet of the bus stop, the response was, we could paint the windows black so they can't look out the windows. I mean, this is insane that they're releasing these people in neighborhoods.
And by the way, Senator, when you say...
You've got to notify people in advance, and it can't be within 2 miles of a school. And when I brought that up to the chairman of the committee, because this was within 10 days of getting the cutoff, it was a very simple bill, just said, you have to notify them in advance, and it can't be within 2 miles of a school. The response I got back was, well, that would put them in isolated rural areas. I go,
good.
Yeah, that's exactly the point.
Well, and,
I mean,
and Senator,
crazy stuff.
Senator, if you've got people who, I mean, every treatment person I've ever talked to about predatory sex offenders say you can't cure them. You can, at best, give them the tools to try to control their own behavior. But if they don't, you know, that you haven't cured them, then putting them in isolated rural areas, if these perverts are tempted by young ladies and young children, and they're tempted by that, what better place to put them than somewhere away from the population of the rest of the state?
Put them in commercial areas or industrial areas or something
good.
Like that. Where they're not subject to children. They're releasing pedophiles in a neighborhood with kids riding around and bikes and all that stuff. And I said, you know, and the response we got back is, well, they have a constitutional right. I said, that's true, they do. The same constitution that protects our gun rights and all this other stuff that we look for that protection does protect their rights, but they don't have to do this in a neighborhood where you're risking children. So are you willing to risk your family, your daughters, and it's mostly women and children, are you willing to risk your women and children to these pedophiles in a neighborhood? Are you crazy?
And by the way, when they say they have a constitutional right, which right are they referring to? Because
well, the fact that they, in Washington, they served their sentence. So the judge commits them to, let's say, 15 years. So they serve that 15 years, and they say, well, they're still not able to be released, so we're going to civilly commit them until we deem that they're okay to be released. And I do want to bring this up, that this is a cost-saving item. They're releasing these people off of McNeil Island to save money. In Washington State, we have them isolated on an island, and we're doing this to save money. Now, they're spending $70 billion. They couldn't give taxpayers a tax break of any consequence. And they're risking people's lives, releasing criminals left and right, and now they're releasing sex predators. And then they want to take away our gun rights. I mean, this is insane.
No, well, tell me this. Why you started with the business about the tribes, which I also mentioned yesterday, and for the life of me, I didn't understand. The tribes are sovereign nations. Wouldn't you think a sovereign nation would want to be notified by another government, a state government, when you're about to send a pedophile back to that sovereign nation? Why was Inslee cutting them out?
Which was one of the reasons for the proviso. But I was actually pretty shocked that he did veto this because it was tribes. I mean, normally the Democrats are falling all over themselves for tribal stuff.
Yeah, normally. But so what were they doing? Just sticking it to the tribes and then sticking it to the community as well?
And again, if you read why he did it, he said, well, this is redundant because they're already notifying them. I go, well, you know, when you have this, and it said, okay, we're going to set up this pilot program to notify people in advance. That was the big deal with the proviso. It notified people in advance of people being released. And that was the big deal to me.
Well,
and,
they know, Senator.
Then people have an input on knowing that they're going to do this, and they could object.
Well, and that's critical because think about this. What Jay Inslee is saying is we're going to release these people. And if we tell the public ahead of time, they'll be able to object, they'll raise a stink, and we won't be able to release them where we plan to release them. In other
that's
words,
exactly right.
All Inslee
right.
wants to do is
you
say.
Know what I said to the chairman
Please.
Of the committee, I said, I need to get a hearing on my bill. And she said, all this bill does is move the meeting date and put it within 2 miles of a school, which puts them in isolated areas. I go, yeah, that's exactly what the bill does.
Exactly right. That's Senator Phil Fortunato from Washington State, from the legislature. Anybody want to defend what Jay Inslee has done? Coming up in a moment, I want to talk about the luck of the Irish, which may be running out when it comes to free speech. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll get back to your phone calls and emails shortly at 866-HEY-LARS. You know, there's a new hate crime law going into effect. Now, it's happening in Ireland and not here in the United States, but unfortunately, a lot of things happen in Europe, especially Western Europe, and then the knuckleheads, the liberals in America love to say, but Europe is doing it this way. Let me bring this to your attention because I think this is one of those examples where you say, well, how bad can these hate crime laws get? And when they get bad enough, how many rights do we end up losing because certain kinds of speech have been declared as hate crimes? Well, I'll refer to some great reporting by a guy you've heard on the show before, S.A. McCarthy, who writes at Real Clear Investigations. He's not on with me today, but he did this report from Limerick, Ireland, and there's a passing of the most aggressive hate crime law yet in the European Union, including the EU's first legal protections for transgender individuals, which is an issue that, of course, the United States is dealing with right now as well. And the critics say that the bill has really vague language. Now, you might think that's a good thing. It's not a good thing. Anytime you start describing speech in vague terms, it means that that is a, well, that's an opportunity for people who want to use it for political reasons, who want to go out and silence people that they disagree with. They will take that to the bank every single day. And the critics say the vague language could be used to enforce the increasingly progressive Irish government's agenda, a woke agenda, and then muzzle critics of unpopular policies. And it kind of opens up a little bit of a window, as SA points out, into how quickly Ireland, which only legalized abortion about 5 years ago, is moving from its really traditional family-based Roman Catholic traditions to others. The legislation shows that there is a rift between Ireland's leaders and its people. And I've talked about this before because it always seemed like a bit of a mystery to me that I would say to my friends, say, who are pro-death penalty. I'm pro-death penalty. And I say, well, but most of the European countries don't have the death penalty. Do the people not support it there? And if you take a look at the public opinion polls, you'll find out 55 or 60% of the people in Western Europe support, let's say, the death penalty, which is a conservative position generally. And you say, well, if the people support it, why is it that the leadership of the country has made it off limits? And the short answer is because the leadership has decided that the masses are asses and therefore they don't have to listen to the people. And that's beginning to happen in America as well. You might notice that there are a great number of states where state lawmakers will go in and pass a law. They'll say, let's have a law that gives illegal aliens driver's licenses. And you say, but the people of your state don't support that. They say, we don't care what the people think. We're going to do it anyway. It's the right thing to do. In other words, we're going from representative government, where the government, your state lawmakers, your governor, mayors of cities, city councils, school boards are supposed to represent you, the citizens, and that ultimately the right to govern is given with the consent of the governed. Now, that's not the kind of system that's been in place in Europe for a long, long time. Europe had kings and queens. Great Britain still does. And their view is, well, we have divine right to govern. We don't have to have your permission. In America, the founders of this great country said, your rights come from God and not from the government. John Kennedy had a great quote like that in his first inaugural, in which he talked about the radical notion that the rights of men and women come from God and not from the government. You ask your favorite, even your favorite Republican representative, tell them what that quote is, but don't tell them where it came from. And say, do you think that the rights of the citizens come from God or from the government? Now, if you're a real conservative, you'll say your rights come from God, not from the government. And where else could they come from? Because if they don't come from God and they don't come from government, where would you get your rights? And this bill, what they've done in Ireland right now, it treats not just public presentation or dissemination of material. So let's say you go out and have a political rally, or you give a speech like the speech that Donald Trump gave on January 6th, where there's been every effort to try and silence him, that if somebody decides that what you said is hateful, then it can actually be made illegal. They don't have a First Amendment in most of Western Europe. They certainly don't have one in the United Kingdom. It also says that even private preparation or storing of material that is deemed to be hateful, like a meme on your phone or a book that you have on the shelf in your house, that if they decide, this is how broad it is, if they decide that you are hanging on to a book that they disagree with, that the book itself can be illegal, and that your possession of the book can be a crime. And one of the legal scholars who's quoted in this piece says, the bill's definition of hate absolutely fails because there is no coherent attempt to define a term like X that can include X in the proposed definition. I mean, if you define the word desk and say, well, a desk is a desk made of wood or metal. And you say, well, if you define a word with itself, then what does that actually mean? It means nothing at all. And let me give you one example of how radical they have become in Western Europe. Last year, a school teacher was thrown into solitary confinement at a Dublin prison. It's known as Mountjoy, because the teacher refused to call a student by the they-them pronoun, and he cited his Christian faith. And they said, you're not allowed to have those beliefs. You're not allowed to act on those beliefs. Therefore, you go to prison. And as one of the critics of this bill said, George Orwell's 1984 was not an instruction manual. I'm worried that we're getting to that point in this country because we have college professors, one of them in New York City recently, who put a machete to a man's neck and did it on camera. So thank God we've got proof of what happened. That professor has now been fired from her job. It was a woman. It was a person of color who came out, and because she disagreed with a man who was talking about abortion, she put a machete to his neck. Now, is she going to go to prison for that, for threatening somebody's life, putting a knife to somebody's neck where a simple cut could end up slicing your jugular and leave you bleeding and dead on the ground? Doesn't sound like it. In fact, I'm willing to bet that if the college thought they could get away with keeping that professor around, they probably would do it. But this is where we're headed, unless we push back hard. And what I mean by that is tell your conservative friends, your Republican friends, don't adopt the language of the woke. If they say, well, you're not allowed to use the term, you're not allowed to use certain terminology. You're not allowed to speak. No. That's not what the First Amendment says. It says the government isn't allowed to go after your speech unless you are threatening somebody or creating public alarm where you can be charged with disorderly conduct or riot. You're allowed to say whatever you want to say. And the more we accept the silencing of these critics, the fewer freedoms we have. And the bigger the government gets, the smaller the citizen liberties. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. If you're like me, I imagine that you are probably more than a little bit disappointed by the John Durham report, because we went through years as the special counsel investigated the Russiagate conspiracy and collusion of so many people on the left side of the aisle. And at the end of it, we got a big report. It seemed to be an indictment of both the media and the deep state, but it didn't really suggest anybody be prosecuted for it at all. So I thought, to bring myself back down to earth, I'd call on my friend Ben Weingarten, who's an editor at Real Clear Investigations. Ben, welcome back.
Lars, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Should I be as disappointed as I feel? Because all of us kept waiting for John Durham to, he's going to come back and he's going to say, people at the FBI, people in the government, people in the deep state, maybe even including Joe Biden, Barack Obama, and a whole host of other characters, conspired to change the outcome of an American election and steal the ability to make that decision from voters and take it over themselves, like you would in some third world banana republic. And I thought, and nothing came out of it, except you see some things in there that maybe I don't.
Well, look, I think to the extent you were expecting justice, you should be disappointed. That said, the entire time, the entirety of the pendency of the Durham investigation, I urged in my writing that we ought to look at it very skeptically and always question whether or not Durham was an investigator of the investigators or the ultimate company man who would give the appearance of trying to give us at minimum transparency, but in reality not go all the way. And I think there's a major disconnect within the report itself, which is that Durham, to quote him, says that the DOJ and FBI, quote, failed to uphold their mission of strict fidelity to the law with respect to the bevy of outrages that he details in a mass of gory information and damning quotes from line agents and other experts who essentially say that this was a hoax from the start, that the DOJ and FBI and others broke laws, rules, and norms to recklessly pursue Trump-Russia collusion when there was never any there from the start. They totally ignored exculpatory evidence almost the entire way. There was a blatant double standard in the treatment of Trump versus Hillary Clinton. And yet, to your point, and this is where I think the dissatisfaction is more than merited and justified, he doesn't call for radical changes within the FBI and DOJ. And as you allude to, we have to look at, you know, the results of the report, the probe, three false statements cases, only one of which proved successful, and a handful of referrals. And that's it when you're talking about arguably the conspiracy of the century, if not a once in a nation kind of conspiracy. And so I think the biggest deficiencies in this report, I'll tick through them very quickly. Sure. One, he raises the idea that the FBI was manipulated in the report. That is utterly inconceivable given the massive evidence that he lays out about how the FBI and DOJ covered their eyes and ears to what was right in front of them through the entirety of the so-called Trump-Russia collusion investigation. As well, Durham never subpoenaed, to our knowledge, some of the most critical players in the entire scandal, namely James Comey, Andrew McCabe, Peter Strzok, Christopher Steele, Fusion GPS's Glenn Simpson, and last but not least, and this isn't a totally inclusive list here, Barack Obama, who was the commander-in-chief when all the wheels were put into motion here. Durham also never investigated the DNC hack, apparently, or what the heck the Mueller special counsel was doing when it was readily apparent to the Durham special counsel that this was a fraud from the start. And so you look at that and you say, how could you not call for a mass of changes within DOJ and FBI? And how could you not call for a whole slew of prosecutions? And essentially what Durham says is, reading between the lines, I wouldn't be able to win these cases. That may be true when you're talking about litigating in front of a Washington, D.C. or Virginia, essentially deep state sympathetic jury and judge. But then the idea that somehow, and these are his words, he talks about that the FBI needs to return to the rules of old. How are you going to entice people to do that? How are you going to persuade them to do that when no one has paid a price for this massive scandal that Durham laid out? And that, I think, is why the Durham report, intentionally or not, and we have to assume it's unintentional, is a self-indicting report because it points the finger back at Durham of how can you lay out this massive, arguably criminal conspiracy of the nth degree and then not hold anyone accountable or call for radical and revolutionary change. And so it falls upon Congress ultimately then to hold these institutions to account to the extent they can be held to account.
And by the way, most of the Congress, and I say this about Republicans, are feckless. They're like, oh, listen, we don't want to wade into that. It has too many political implications for us. But Ben, this, I guess I can't wrap my head around why if somebody were young in their career, they might say, well, I want to do something, kind of go along, get along, and I'll be the company man. This guy's at the, I would argue, toward the end of his career. You'd think he wouldn't want to be remembered, if that was his concern, his legacy, as the guy who basically said, yeah, all this stuff is happening, and I'm not suggesting the changes that'll stop it from happening again. So we're almost doomed to see it repeat at some point, and you're the guy who gave everybody the essentially the document that says, yep, we should just leave the FBI as it is and ask them pretty please to start following the rules, which ain't going to happen. I mean, why would he do that?
Yeah, it's utterly damning. And I think that if you were to look at it from the perspective of who are the other prosecutors working with him, perhaps they have long careers ahead of them. But I think what this ultimately shows is this is the power of the institutions. Any one man who would dare to come across those institutions would get crushed. This shows that even someone, as you know, at the end of their career, who essentially has nothing to lose here, and could arguably create an amazing legacy for himself with millions of Americans who feel that these institutions, I think rightly so, have been weaponized against them with Trump as a proxy starting in 2016, but continuing to this day. I totally agree. It shows you that that is how strong the power and the hold of these bureaucracies is. By the way, we can see it with how they've all circled the wagons around the FBI leadership and such when it comes to these whistleblowers who appeared before the House Weaponization Subcommittee.
Who are getting crushed, Ben. I mean, these are relatively young men who have careers ahead of them, and they've sacrificed all that, their blood, their treasure, their sacred honor, to stand up and do the right thing. And you've got tens of thousands of FBI agents and a half dozen who've decided to do the right thing, and the rest of them are just keeping their heads down, hoping to keep their pension, I guess.
Absolutely right. And one of the most damning and telling lines that I saw during that hearing was one of the agents, Garrett O'Boyle, when asked if he would recommend to others within the Bureau that they serve as whistleblowers, he said, honestly, I would not, because my life was wrecked as a consequence of this process. And I think that tells you all you need to know about the state of these institutions, where we can least afford to have them hyper-politicized and weaponized because of the awesome power and authority that they have.
Unbelievable. Well, I'm glad you're writing about it. And Ben, I would hope that all of us would say, if I'm near the end of my career and I got one last chance to do something right, even if it costs me a job or whatever, that we do what the young men from the whistleblowers, who most of them, you'll note, served in the military, would say, I'm going to stand up and do the right thing and damn the consequences. It's the right thing for America. And shame on everybody else in those agencies for not doing the right thing as well. Ben Weingarten is one of the editors at Real Clear Investigations. We always appreciate his insight. I'll get to your phone calls and emails in just a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I don't want to get to your phone calls. Brian's been waiting a long time, and we don't like to do that. But Brian, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today? Hey, Brian. Maybe we waited so long that Brian just expired. Brian, are you there? I'll tell you what, I'll have Donovan check in with him. I got this email from Pat Ferry, who's in Bellingham, and that means he listens on KGMI or he listens on stream, live stream on the Radio Northwest Network. And he said, and I know this point of view, I've heard it a lot. Sorry, Lars, but this whole debt ceiling thing is a bunch of hype to scare the public and act as a diversion from watching what the left hand is doing, Biden corruption hearings, Hunter Biden laptop crimes, etc. The feds take in $320 billion a month in revenue. The interest on the debt is $65 billion a month. So that leaves plenty of money to pay for Social Security and Medicare. If they can't agree on the debt, then all federal government employees and all unearned entitlement programs, except military and law enforcement, get no funding. I'm really sick and tired of these moron politicians creating these crises, one right after another, and letting deadlines go to the breaking point. They'll reach an agreement at the last minute like they always do. It's totally ridiculous, and it's uncalled for. Well, I agree with that last part, where he says they create these crises. In a lot of ways, when the federal government tackles a problem, the Congress or the president, and they wait till the very last minute, they're like the kid in high school that you knew, and maybe you were that kid, who knew that there was a major term paper due on the 1st of June. And he knew it 3 months ahead, and he didn't bother to start writing it until the night before it was due. Now, that's when kids do that, you kind of understand it, although you hope they learn their lesson. Because when they wait till the last minute to finish up a necessary task, it usually doesn't get done very well. But where Pat misunderstands is the amount of money that our federal government is paying. And there are people out there who believe, well, the majority of the money is spent on salaries. That is not the case. Okay, so if you think that the federal government is running us into bankruptcy because of spending on the military or federal government employees like the FBI, the U.S. Marshals, the Forest Service, and the rest, that's not it at all. In fact, I'll give you a couple of examples. One, the Department of Education, one of the most useless agencies in the federal government. They spend a little over $100 billion a year, so not quite a third of $1 billion a day. And you say, why don't we fire everybody at the Department of Education? I say, great, we're going to fire everybody at the Department of Education. That won't save very much at all. There aren't that many people who work at the Department of Education. Well, where's the money going then? The money goes out the door in the form of grants that go out to school districts. So I would cut the Department of Education tomorrow. I'd cut it down to zero. I'd get rid of the agency altogether. We'd save $1 trillion in the next 10 years. Those are the real numbers. But it's not because you cut personnel. Personnel isn't the problem. Two-thirds of the federal government's budget is funding Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and other federal pensions. So when people say, I want to cut the government, I say, well, do you want to cut the Pentagon? That's about $700 billion a year. And you say, no, we don't want to cut that. How about cut the interest on the debt? In other words, we want to cut we want to default on America's debt, which the country has never done. That adds up to about another $700 billion every year. As he said, about $65 billion a month, $700 billion every year. And you say, so where do you want to cut? If you're not going to cut the Pentagon, we need to cut from Social Security and Medicare. And you say, well, you can't cut that. And I said, okay, that's two-thirds of the entire budget is spent on those two things. If you add in the Pentagon, then it takes it up higher than that. Well, why are we in so much trouble? Because we've run up so much debt that literally just paying interest on the debt is almost as big a bill as the bill for the entire Pentagon. $600-700 billion a year, about $2 billion every year. Well, it's we take in about $320 billion a month. We spend $65 billion a month on interest on the debt. About $2 billion a day is an easier way to think about it. But when people say we're taking in all that money, we are. But the federal government spends more money than it takes in. And it does that by a deficit that's usually around $1 trillion every year. Now, $1 trillion is real money. If you take $1 billion, that's about $3 from every man, woman, and child in America. So a family of four would contribute $12. But and it's a good way to kind of bring it down to where you can understand how much money. If it's $1 trillion, we're talking about $8,000 for every man, woman, and child in America, about $12,000 for a family. So if you spend that much more than what you take in, that's the route to bankruptcy. And at some point, you're going to have to say, well, we have to cut something. And when you start with the fact that two-thirds of the federal government's budget is entitlement payments to Social Security, to Medicare, and to other federal pensions, there's almost no place to cut at that point. So we got to have some cuts, and we got to have some borrowing, and we got to have both. And Joe says no. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.